Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held at London's Olympia. This episode is all about clean label.
Today, we're going to be talking around the theme of clean label, bold taste, making natural work at scale. So thinking about the brand side innovation realities of actually trying to make things that are natural by the label, right? Clean label, simpler label, that kind of stuff. Today, I'm joined by Neil, Emily, and Sally. All have unique and very learned perspectives. We're going to have a little chat and hopefully push each other to give you an interesting discussion and some novel perspectives. I'll ask each of the panelists to introduce themselves. And I'll also ask you guys to think of questions to pose to us after you hear our backgrounds and expertise. Really think of how we can push this forward so it makes it more valuable for all of us and we have lots of stuff to take away and start working on, right? To give you a brief introduction to me, I'm a flavor chemist. I worked for 10 years for IFF. Before that, I worked for a smaller flavor house. Currently, as of two years, I've been a consultant working specifically in flavor science, so creating flavors for products, working on brand launches, but also specifically on digital systems. So working on AI, right? And what is AI? Working on multidimensional machine learning models, that kind of stuff. Yeah, pretty cool things. These guys are way more interesting than me. So if you guys would like to go ahead, Neil, you can start.
Okay. Hi, guys. I'm Neil Rankin. I'm a chef, and I'm the co-founder of Simplicity Foods. We manufacture all-natural, clean-label meat alternatives using lacto-fermentation and vegetables. And we supply thousands of restaurants, and we've just launched in Sainsbury's. No, Waitrose and Ocado.
Is the Sainsbury's a hopeful?
No, actually, we are about to. Which is why it's on my mind. But I'm not supposed to say that.
So. Don't tell anybody. We told you were going to hear like groundbreaking news today.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily Anderson. I'm the MPD manager for Couplin's Bakery. So I look after both MPD and EPD across all product categories, which is quite varied. Couplin's have about 160 shops across the Northeast and Yorkshire, and we offer true value for money for our customers without ever compromising on quality. So in terms of colour and flavour, that's making sure that the quality is where we want it to be, but it works in our products.
Okay, and I'm Sally Loughlin. I lead the Global Consumer Science Organisation at Mondelez International. You probably know us. We make Cadbury, Oreo, Sour Patch Kids. I'm responsible for driving the consumer-led innovation portfolio within Mondelez and responding to consumers' needs and trends. And this is a very hot topic at the moment.
Amazing. So as you can see, we've got three very different perspectives. And in a way, I've kind of framed this hopefully in a fun way, right? But frame this in the kind of perspective-led discovery that we're going to get from each of the panelists. So Neil will hopefully explain what's possible as he's developed new products, actually sold them, making sure that you can use novel techniques, novel tools to actually create a product that is then sellable into restaurants, into supermarkets, etc. Emily was going to tell us what scales. What doesn't scale, how things scale with specific focus on colors. So changing from, let's say, artificial colors to natural colors, what are the kind of attributes that you now need to consider, the variables that have to be controlled in order to make natural color work at scale? And then Sally is going to tell us what sticks, both at the beginning and at the end. Being consumer science, you're really telling us what the market is and then telling us whether we've met the need, right? So if I open up with a question for each of you and you answer from your own perspectives, what does it actually mean to you to say making natural work at scale? Neil, can you answer from your experience and based specifically on, let's say, fermentation, what is natural?
Natural for me means no shortcuts and just using things that are everyday available to everybody. I think for me, the purpose of simplicity and the grounding idea that I had at the beginning was based in a world of a lot of plant-based alternatives that are super unnatural. I wanted at the end of it to be able to say that I could grow that product in my own back garden and then make it in my own kitchen. And I think that's as close to, in the manufacturing sense, where we got. And throughout our experience from doing it in a small kitchen or a small restaurant up to scaling up to now sort of 5-6 tons a week, we've kept that dial. We've kept on that line and not moved away from it.
Amazing. Okay, so that's good. And it's going to feed right into, like, how do you make these things work at scale? And you just said keeping nature to do what nature does, right? Like, let's see if we can hijack, in a way, what it already does and enhance those attributes in order to give us something better.
I don't think there's anything necessary. We need anything more than that. I think there's so much, you know. I just think it's a weird factor to eat an apple and then to think, well, we need to create a sweet that tastes like an apple. It's like, got the apple. Why the hell are we doing this? And I think this is where we as humans, the innovation takes over and you leave the good thing behind. Whereas I haven't come from that world. I've come from a chef world.
Yeah.
So, and I think my biggest skill in this is ignorance of the entire sphere of manufacturing. And I think if I'd had that knowledge before, I wouldn't have done what I've done.
Amazing.
We've gone in a purely ignorant path and kind of come out the other end unscathed. Well, not unscathed, but, you know.
Amazing. So it's kind of a making a market for those vegetables as they are.
I don't see that as a manufacturing process. I see it as a cooking process, and I've always did that. And I think that's kind of where we've had our benefits and our losses, because obviously scalability is quite hard. The equipment's not always there for us to use, because everybody just feeds off the same sort of equipment. They would use the same sort of techniques to preserve and to keep the length, whereas we've just relied on what's already there. So it's been harder for us because there's nothing for us to copy.
Yeah, cool. I get that. That's cool. Okay, so now for you, Emily, answering, I guess, the same question, but from your perspective. You're producing new products and you want to get something onto the market, or maybe you're enhancing something that is existing, right? Like EPD.
Yeah.
What does natural mean at scale?
So I think our natural journey's probably started very differently. I would say it started with the Southampton 6 study, which kind of highlighted 6 colours which were proven, or, you know, the study done kind of proved that they caused hyperactivity in children. And at that point, consumers decided that, you know, they didn't want artificial colours. There's obviously a lot more artificial colours out there than the 6 studied. But that's the point at which Couplins realised that artificial colours weren't the way forward. In terms of manufacturing, they're brilliant. You know, you put them in, they stay the same colour that you wanted them to be. They're really easy to use. They're not affected by oxygen, light, heat, anything. They're just the colour that you want. They're nice and vibrant. But if it's not what customers want, it's not what you should be putting in your product. So natural in terms of colours for us is food colours, which are sourced from fruits, vegetables, concentrated, and then added to foods that way. So we call them colouring foodstuffs. And that's where our focus is. So you've kind of got the intermediate between artificial and natural, which is your carmine, copper chloride, that copper chlorophyllin. But it is the colouring foodstuffs that we'd like to move everything to, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it is a journey, right?
It is, yes.
It's a journey. We're thinking specifically about these kinds of things. Obviously, the Southampton Six, everyone's going to have a different opinion about, like, consumers want something, and we'll talk about that in a second, of what is that actually worth, right? Like, at the end of the day, what is natural worth? What is this or that worth? I feel like sometimes when a study is published, people jump on the bandwagon of, oh, this is carcinogenic, and everyone kind of forgets maybe the dosage, right? And yeah. At what level did this start making rats purple, right? And is that equivalent to the amount of purple coloring in a muffin? Maybe not, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes we need to think, I guess, practically about that. But then equally, how do you transfer that message, disseminate that message to a consumer that kind of only has the headline? So I find I see where you're coming from, and I see that as difficult. If we talk specifically about some of the extra attributes that now you have to control,
yes,
when using a natural alternative to an existing color, in an existing product, right? Can you talk about some of those attributes? Things like temperature, light, pH.
Yeah. So all of them affect color, one way or another, and it's looking at the application that you're putting the color into, and working out which attributes are going to affect it. So, for example, if we're putting it into a buttercream or an icing, then we're not so worried about heat, because that stays at ambient temperature the whole life. If we're putting it into a product that we're going to display in our window, then light is actually really important. I'd say we're quite fortunate in that our shelf lives are really short. We don't have products with months of life on them. But you put a product into a window, and if it's in the sunshine, 24, 48 hours, it can start losing colour. So it's thinking about the product. pH is a good one. So a lot of natural colours do perform better at lower pHs. But if you add something like citric acid, you're impacting the flavour. And it's the balance between that flavour, which obviously has to be optimum, and the life of your colour. And actually, do you shorten the shelf life because you want to keep your colour rather than adding something like citric acid?
Yeah, and I guess in a weird way for you, determining the full environment that the product has access to is really important, right? Yes. Like, is it going to be on a shelf, right? Is it going to be in a shop window? Is it open to oxygen? Is it open to air? But one of, I guess, the good benefits is that you're producing products that have a shelf life of a day.
Yes.
Which is actually amazing.
So, right? So some of our products have less than 24 hours. So they're finished on a night shift, out to shops by the next morning, and then we stop selling them at 3 p.m. Just a couple. Most will have at least a couple of days. But we do have very, very fast turnarounds, and we bake every day.
Which is kind of like a benefit and a risk, right?
It is,
like,
yes.
It becomes a challenge.
Definitely pros and cons.
Something to think about, and you don't have to answer right now because I'll move on to Sally. But when this is another attribute, when moving from artificial color to natural color, have you found any specific problems with introducing allergens? So anthocyanins as allergens. And does that therefore limit your market, your available market? So think about that.
Okay.
And then when you answer, give it to me.
Yeah. I can probably answer on the allergens because it's quite a straightforward answer in that luckily we haven't found any allergen risks when bringing natural colours in because they're mostly based on carrot, beetroot, paprika, safflower, those kind of products. There's no major risks. We are always told about the safflower, which is a really good yellow colour, but isn't currently permitted in the US, which would impact a lot of businesses, but we don't export. So no, we haven't had any issues with allergens at all.
Cool. Yeah, awesome. And that was literally perfect timing. We're really asking what sticks, right? You're leading consumer science at Mondelez, and fundamentally, you need to know that what NPD is working on that, or the business is currently doing, how does performance actually match to these claims or these things that we say consumers want? When we say consumers want natural, okay, but how much is it worth? What is the weight of that lever?
It's a good question. And it's a difficult one to answer because consumers have an expectation in their head about what something should look like, particularly in the world of candy sweets, where you have the vibrant colours which reflect some of the attributes that they have, you know, high flavour, high sourness. And when you move to a more natural flavour, natural colour, you reduce the intensity of that colour. So you actually have to basically tell them that you've moved to natural colours and therefore the expectation for them lowers. There's a whole link between appearance and flavour that is a construct that consumers don't understand, but they live by. And so you have to give them the context of what this is so that their expectations are filled. So as soon as they know something's all natural, they're fine with it. But if they are used to something being the way it was, so for example, a bright, vibrant candy, and now it's gone to a less vibrant colour because you've had to move to a more natural colour, you have to give them the context of the change.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that would be under a similar brand, right? So
yes, same brand. Same.
And it's you're trying to get like for like.
Yeah.
You realise that you sometimes can't. In MPD, you can't always. It's impossible.
So okay. For example, we had to remove titanium dioxide from a lot of products.
Yeah.
The titanium dioxide gives a certain vibrancy of colour, and in some of the drinks that we make, they give a certain translucency that is needed. We had to help consumers through that process so we didn't lose our business to enable them to understand why we had made changes that were the right thing to do from a regulatory perspective, even though the consumers didn't want it. They weren't asking for it.
Yeah.
So it's not always consumer driven. Quite often these things are regulatory driven.
Okay.
So for example, in America with Amaha, you know, make America healthy again. Interesting with all of their fast food. It is a real challenge for consumers because they're not used to that.
It's good. I think it's good to get onto the legislative part of it, right? Sometimes it's not necessarily legislative, but it is legislative suggested. As an example,
exactly.
There are allowable limits to put certain foodstuffs into it, like as the classic E-numbers. E-numbers gives you hyperactivity, right? And then people go, oh, well, all E-numbers must be bad, right? And everyone forgetting that ascorbic acid, an antioxidant, is E300, also vitamin C. Without vitamin C, all of those pirates would have got scurvy and we wouldn't have had Pirates of the Caribbean. And what a great film. What a great series of films. So it's really good when we talk about these different things and talk about control, right? There's like different levels of control in what we're trying to put out to consumers. And fundamentally, every one of us has the same available consumer base, right? And different markets that we're targeting. And this is what I was talking about.
I mean,
about
our
yesterday.
Consumers are probably the same consumers that, you know, I mean, I bet your consumers still eat Cadbury's or.
Yes. Yeah.
So we all have the same consumers.
Exactly.
It's just the context that they're operating in changes.
Yeah. And that kind of consumption moment changes.
Yeah.
And therefore their expectations are changing, right?
Are different.
Yeah. And when we're talking about control and how we kind of map these different products that we're putting onto the market, they're all kind of very different, right? Mm-hmm. Based on different consumption moments. You know exactly what a consumer is putting in their mouth. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know exactly what a consumer is putting in their mouth because you put all of those things in and you've tested to see what comes out. When we're talking about the results of a process, do you know exactly what the consumer is putting in their mouth as the chef?
Yes, I would say in most cases. Depends if we're selling towards a restaurant, not necessarily, because that then becomes a cooking product to go to somebody else. So, for instance, I mean, we make an all-natural product. We make burgers for about 1,000-plus restaurants in the UK. I would say most of those would then put artificial cheese and a couple other things in it. So I think that a lot of the benefits from our product, which doesn't taste artificial, has all the benefits from it, are just kind of gazumped straight away. But as soon as they slap that bit of cheese on, which I just try and get them not to do. But that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, mostly it's a cooking thing, so I can't control the way people cook or how they eat. And as you were saying, like, I think most of the people that we deal with are not, well, they're not vegans per se. They would be sort of people just experimenting with sort of plant-based ingredients. So they would be meat eaters and everything anyway. And also, I mean, I eat the occasional junk food and
things like that.
It's not.
I think one of the most telling things that you said at the beginning, and I think some people get to this, is that a chef doesn't put something into a product in order to hide something else that's already in the product.
Correct.
There's no such thing really as masking. You're like you're trying to work on this kind of concerto of different things, adding different elements in order to get one.
Good ingredients in, good ingredients out. And I think that's a bit of the problem in our category, is that most of the stuff, take pea protein as an example, like bitter, you know, like super bitter. And this thing, most plant-based proteins are bitter. So once you're starting with something that doesn't taste very nice, it's like a big pot of soup, and you've got this thing, you're like, oh, well, let me just add this, and I'm going to get this and do this. And then it just becomes this confusing mess, and you lose the heart of what it is. Because if you start from something that doesn't have that sort of, you know, that satisfaction, it's never going to have it. You're just going to be masking over with something else.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just putting more and more stuff in that's not necessarily what you wanted as the end goal.
Yeah, you better just throw it out and start again in my book.
Yeah, cool. It's, I guess, interesting perspectives. When you're developing a brand new product, Emily, what are the first things that you think about?
We'd start with, you know, what we're trying to achieve with it. Where we want it to sit in the range. Is it targeted at adults, targeted at children? Is it a snack, a treat, a lunch product, a breakfast? You know, what are we developing? And then if we've got, say, let's say, a sweet product, we'll then look at the flavor profiles, the color. We find that in bakery, it's really easy to have an entirely beige counter.
Yeah.
And beige counters don't look appealing. They don't sell. We need some colour in there somewhere. So we look at where we can add the colour. It has to be appropriate. You know, you can't just make everything blue and green and yellow, because that also won't look good. We can do it through packaging. We can do it through natural ingredients. And then we use colours to add vibrancy to toppings, decorations. The country loves sprinkles at the moment. Everything looks better with some hundreds and thousands on it. So that's one of the trends that we've really seen coming through recently, the whole school cake. People remember it. I'm sure when people remember it from school, it had artificial colours in. But ours sells really well for us, but is entirely natural colours.
So when thinking specifically, like you're making a new product, you have specific targets, right? You know, if you were to realise your dreams, this thing is going to be worth something. You have big sellers, right? You have things that you produce constantly. And I'm guessing you'll have things that are maybe limited time offers or things that you're testing.
Yeah.
So you'll try, oh, this is a green banana cake or I don't know, whatever, right?
We haven't yet tried green banana cake.
I work on commission. When you create this product, you have your own specific targets, and some of those targets are cost, some of those targets are availability, supply, that kind of stuff. How do you prioritize that? Like, how do you prioritize building a new thing that is not currently on a shelf?
Yeah.
Based on each of those attributes.
So for us, quality is always number one. The one thing that we will not compromise on is the quality. Price is also really valuable. So we know that our consumers are quite price sensitive. We want treats to be affordable, everyday treats. So that's quite a close second. Artificial colours are cheaper than natural, but actually in the quantities that we're using them, it is worth the slightly higher price to put the natural colours in, because that's what people appreciate. And then lots of other things factor into the process, which kind of, depending on the product, rank further down. But I'd definitely say quality first, price second.
Oh, cool. Sally, for you, the exact same question. What are the targets? What are your first targets, and how do you prioritize them in developing something new to the market?
Yeah, so I mean, it determines whether or not the consumer wants it, number one. Yeah. But also in terms of designing a product, you are designing, number one, because it's food, taste. Taste is number one. Taste, and as Emily says, quality. You know, we're a packaged goods company, so we have to deliver products through a supply chain, potentially globally, with multiple factories. So there's a whole load of quality that's driven into our supply chain, and how do we deliver that quality? But taste is the number one thing. And then everything that comes with taste, so texture, appearance, which color is part of it. So, you know, number one is taste. I can honestly say that we want to deliver the best tasting products that consumers will want to come to again and again. You know, it in moderation, absolutely. So that's the important thing. But let's make sure we're designing products, are delivering it against those things, and with the right price point as well, because consumers are very, very price sensitive. We've lived through the cocoa crisis.
Mm-hmm. We're still living.
Yeah, the cost of living crisis and all of the wars that are going on, and watching what's happened with pricing has been incredibly interesting. So price is critical. We have to deliver at a certain cost to consumers so that they can afford it. And we are part of a big repertoire of products that they buy in the supermarkets.
Yeah, this is probably not for now, but I guess like disruptions of existing supply chains for commodity goods is something that is like really sensitive for you.
Hugely sensitive, particularly on cocoa, which is our probably... Yeah. Cocoa and flour are number one commodities. So, you know, we are very driven by those market constraints that happen. And then you see the consumers reacting to it. So those overwhelm anything where consumers are saying, well, I want natural. The cost, what we're seeing is cost is number one in terms of purchase.
As a consumer.
But then, you know, the quality and everything. And then certain consumers do have these internal paradigms about natural.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if anybody saw the talk yesterday on UPF, but there was a lot of, you know, emulsifiers are bad. Eggs have got emulsifiers in them. Artificial sweeteners are bad. You know, blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of people with certain internal narratives.
I think the important thing... from my perspective, to add to this, is it's not the poison that kills you; it's the dosage.
It's the dosage. I mean, I used to work in healthcare.
Yeah,
you know, you take too much paracetamol, you will die. But you know, hopefully
you won't have a headache, though. You won't have a headache.
No, definitely, and you won't have any aches or pains.
It is interesting the difference between a packaged product and an unpackaged product.
Absolutely.
Because we actually package very few of our products. And because they're all displayed open in a counter, customers very much come in and choose with their eyes. So I think, obviously, taste is really important, but it's never going to be picked out of the counter if it doesn't look good.
Yes.
In the first instance. It then has to deliver, because they're not going to come back if it doesn't also taste good. But it's probably a slight difference in how customers are choosing what they're going to buy.
I completely agree. But I think when they open the packet,
we
have, if it doesn't
they're
look
still
the
going
way
to look first.
It's supposed to, get lots of issues.
The exact same question for you, but slightly different, because you're coming from a kind of a novel perspective compared to the consumer packaged goods and being a chef. I remember being a chef when I was at university and coming up with menus for the new week and things like that. And it was awesome because you get to like reinvent yourself every single week and you get to create something new. But there's still that priority list, right? There's still, what is your target? What this dish needs to be worth a certain amount to us, and it needs to cost a certain amount to produce. What are those priority things that you think about? And I'm guessing it can't just be like, oh my God, that's cool.
I mean, there's a world that I would live in. And I would make stuff in a certain way. And then there's a world that I've actually got to sell it to somebody at the end of the day. Yeah. But we started off in a place where I think there wasn't really a big demand for what we were doing. Everybody was super obsessed with plant-based, being like, oh my God, that's amazing. That looks, that bleeds. That does this. This does this. Why don't you just do this? And I was like, no, I don't get it. So like flavor was the number one thing that we hit. And I think with that, brings a multitude of other things. Like if you have a natural flavor product, then it is also inherently quite healthy, because there's nothing apart from, you know, if you're buying fruit and vegetables that taste good towards flavors things and using techniques, then it will be healthy by proxy. It's not going to be unhealthy.
There's maybe something we should talk about behind the stage later.
Yeah. But secondary to that, I think from an ethical perspective, I think we've always been on the basis that we didn't want to use not chemicals by thing, but even products that weren't freely available. And I think that you know, we wanted to use massively available products, but mushrooms, beetroot, onions are 90% of what we buy. You know, we're not buying something which is not accessible to everybody. And that comes to one, that it can be grown correctly. You can find different suppliers, so you don't need to be subject to one supplier. And then also, cost perspective, that something is freely available, there's lots of it and it's abundant, you're not paying a high price for it. So we actually get a sustainable business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I guess you can, you have multiple suppliers. So you have multiple suppliers of a particular thing, and it means that you can kind of, secure that, right?
Yeah, well,
mitigate risk.
Seasonally, we will buy, for instance, like we'll buy some of our vegetables. When I was in a restaurant, the same thing, you know, buy from Europe is sometime there, and then it goes to the UK, and you switch between it. And because we use fermentation, we can actually keep the stuff longer. So even the expensive periods, we can bypass that. And so it's a much more controllable business model. If you're just using something like that, rather than identifying this one specific ingredient that everybody really wants and can't get their hands off, and then you're subject to that guy and their pricing, and then that blows you out of the water and makes everything so expensive.
Thinking specifically, like we've all said, number one, flavor and quality, right? And it has to be the same, reproducible. How do you, from the outset, think about a product that you want to produce and then create the fermentation conditions in order to then produce it?
All of our fermentation conditions are because we do well fermentation. So, but we just keep everything simple. And that's the name of our company. It is a three vegetable lacto ferment. It never really goes wrong. We've never had much more than one batch barrel that's gone wrong.
I thought you were going to say, wow, we've never really had one poisoning.
No. There's a taste for it. No, we've got the pH level sorted, and yeah, that's fine. But sometimes it gets a bit funky. If it's, I would imagine some of the stuff in the factory last week will have got a little bit extra funk on them. It's fine, but that controllable. Also, I think you have to be a little bit free from it and go, you know, we're not making a product that's going to taste exactly the same every week in, week out, and let go of that a little bit, and then balance that up. And I think that the end customer understands that, because there's a little bit changeability to it.
I really like the fact that, like, sometimes I feel like there's a different level of viscerality to certain things. Like, you're closer to your product and you're closer to your consumers. You're slightly further away, but still very close. You probably know many of your consumers, but you don't know them by name, right?
Yeah.
There's a kind of a distance to that. Well, I wanted to ask a different question about seasonality. Like, how are you affected by seasonality?
Not at all, because we do that. So we're buying very simple ingredients that are available all year round.
Okay.
The only thing that affects the season is the hot weather.
So
or really cold weather, because it takes a long time.
Yeah.
But that can be remedied with a temperature-controlled fermentation thing, or using, you know, or buying our ferments from somewhere else, or doing something a little bit more artificial. We don't want to do that. I like the wild side. I think you get a little bit more out of it.
Okay, that's all good. And Emily, from how are you affected by seasonality, both positive and negative?
Yeah, I think it's the most natural ingredients which are most affected by seasonality. So, for example, strawberry tarts, strawberries. We put fresh strawberries in them. They're far easier to come by. Enough quality ones at this time of year than it is in winter, where obviously they come from further afield. We also see challenges in shops. So I've mentioned the window displays that we have. In winter, you can pretty much guarantee they're not going to be in the sun. At this time of year, there is some chance that they might be in the sun. And it's communicating to our shop colleagues that the window display does need to change depending on the weather to make sure that the right products are in there. Some products can go in the window display and then are perfectly good to sell once they've been in. Some products are only in the window display and then we wouldn't sell them afterwards. So it's really just making sure that we know how the season is going to affect the product and then reacting accordingly.
Yeah. It's just actually reminded me of something kind of a little bit off, but I wanted to talk about it now. Can you remember you spoke before about pH dependency of color and how you set those things right, and actually they're affected by UV and you kind of get that like color degradation over time. We actually had an interesting study on how UV was affecting the color of a particular product. It was a beverage, and it wasn't the UV itself that was affecting the product and the anthocyanins, the natural color that was in the product. It was actually the UV was degrading the long chain fatty acids within the product base.
Yeah.
And the cleavage of those long chain fatty acids into smaller chain acids, that was driving the pH, which affected the color.
Yes.
So like looking more into what happens within a product, then you're able to do something to mitigate it. But yeah.
We have found that as well. So a lot of colours are more stable in fat-based products. So if you use a colour in a buttercream, for example, you can get one, you know, really good, vibrant colour. You put exactly the same product colouring into a water-based icing and get an entirely different result. You almost have to, when you're changing the base for your colour, you need to start the work again.
Yeah.
You can't just, you know, transfer it from one thing to the other. It's everything is different. And then when you start adding in baking colours, it's all change again. And things that were stable in are no longer stable.
I didn't hear what you said. When you start adding in
baking. If you were to put it into a batter or something to bake, changes the whole everything.
Sally? How is Mondelez affected by seasonality?
Gosh, well, we've had a cocoa cost issue. We flour, oil, you know, all of those change seasonally, and we have to make sure that the quality of those ingredients is right. And then equally, we're a global business. So when you think about the fact that we sell chocolate in environments like India, where you have small stores, we have challenges there, just like you, in terms of the shop, you know, where do you store it? And in India, we have these things called Visi coolers. So chocolate is stored there. But also the chocolate is a different chocolate. So if you taste the chocolate in India or Australia, it tastes very different from chocolate here, because it's what's called tropicalized, because it can withstand different temperatures. So there's a whole, it's either finished goods or the raw materials. You know, there's huge seasonal effects that, you know, really challenge our business, and which is where our procurement company comes in terms of securing the best supply.
Mm-hmm. And this is a question for all of you guys again. It's kind of similar, but how are you, and do you feel, affected by the change in seasonality because of global warming? I mean,
cocoa is the number one.
Vanilla.
We've had vanilla. There's something on pistachio at the moment that's happening. So there are huge global trends that are hitting us left, right, and center. And trying to secure a supply chain for our ingredients is really challenging.
And securing your supply chain for
the quality that the consumer expects, because the consumer expects an Oreo to always taste the same.
Yeah.
They expect a Chips Ahoy cookie to always taste the same. So if you have some of the brands that we have where consumers are quite happy with some variation. So we have a brand in the US called Tate's, which is much more of a natural type of brand. Consumers accept variability in those cookies. But when you have a very sort of stable Oreo, it has to taste the same every time you taste it. So the raw materials that come in have to be controlled. The manufacturing has to be controlled. So that's the challenges that we have within this global business that we have.
It's kind of madness, right? We're all going to the shop every single day, going to the shelf, and for consumer packaged goods, right? We're expecting our Nesquik strawberry, yep. Other brands are available. We're expecting that Cadbury's chocolate to be the same every single time.
Yeah.
But in reality, that's not natural, right?
That's why we have to have ingredients that stabilize our products to enable them to be exactly the same. And that's the challenge today.
Yeah.
Particularly when we see consumers coming to us and saying, the quality is not the same. You've got too many ingredients.
Yeah.
How do we react to that? And that is one, that's a big trend that's hitting us now. And how do we formulate and manufacture to deliver against those consumer needs, which are really coming in strongly today? It's a big headwind for us.
This is probably going to make a lot of people cringe because it's a management consultancy term that people use, right? But the framework is how the game works, right? And the rules of the game have been dictated to us,
yeah.
Not by us. So we're playing someone else's game by their rules. And sometimes those things don't make sense anymore, right? Sometimes the rules that we live by right now are not relevant to our modern life, and they take a long time to catch up with us, yeah. Right? So sometimes we're trying to produce products in a market in order to make them the same as they were, but they aren't the same anymore because the rules of the game have changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's something specific. It's a specific challenge that a lot of people in NPD and especially in food will face. And
particularly with cost.
Yeah.
You know, when we're seeing all the raw materials going up in cost, we're being expected to make products at the same price. It's incredibly challenging. And we have to look after not only our profit margins, but those of the retailers. So we have to think about the retailers.
Yeah.
Exactly. Otherwise, little Johnny's not getting a trampoline for Christmas, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I think overall, the theme of this, I've tried to classify into the three main abilities, right? And they all affect us in different ways because we're all coming at it from different perspectives. But the abilities are variability, sustainability, and availability. Can you pick one, choose one, talk about all three and how they specifically affect you in your business? Availability, variability, sustainability. Emily.
Please, need to read them again.
Availability, variability, sustainability.
So variability, I think what you were just saying about consumers expecting the same product every single time, is possibly slightly different for us in that, to a certain extent, they definitely do. If they bought a product in one shop in Hornsey and then they buy the same product in Darlington, they do want it to taste the same. But we probably have a little bit more freedom for variation between products with being a hand-finished bakery. And every product, in some way or other, is you know, hand-finished. Products are decorated by hand, hand-piping. And that having that, letting customers know that that is what you do does give you more freedom for things to be slightly different. People don't expect consistency.
Not as much,
but they do still pick up if they think you've changed an ingredient or if they think it's smaller than it used to be or other things. They're really sensitive to changes, even though we've got that little bit more of a window that we can manufacture within.
I'll say them again.
Yeah.
Okay, they're all abilities,
yeah.
But not as in normal abilities, right? Like, so I can juggle, right? That's an ability, but I try to make them sound cool. Availability, variability, sustainability. Not really abilities, besides the word.
I think availability and sustainability are sort of inbuilt into our business model. And because we're not huge, and we're not a big company, I think that's more of a control. We have more control over that. And I think the variability side, I think I quite like it. I quite like things being a little bit different. And I think as well, being small, that's okay. And being in the space we're in, I think it's okay because people don't eat our product on its own that often. I think there's an allowable amount of variability. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you on the chocolate thing. I just came back from Japan and I was like, oh, the chocolate over here just tastes like this and I understand that and I know what that kind of chocolate, like American chocolate, tastes like, and I understand what our chocolate tastes like. And there's really specific, like I have Tony's Chocolony quite a lot at home, and I would know if that changed, and I'd be like, what's going on here? But I would hate to be in that position with our food. Luckily, we're not in that, because I think most people just have that as a burger with a thing. They'll put different ingredients with it. They'll put it in a different thing. So I think we could sort of get away with it, kind of the same way meat does. You know, like a steak would not taste the same over a period of time. You wouldn't throw an apple back at Sainsbury's if they gave you one that tasted different from the week before.
You're expecting it.
I think you're expecting it. And I think with our thing, that kind of brings us the things to do that. I think people in my technical department would disagree with me.
Yeah.
They would probably like hate me for saying this and say, it always tastes the same. I don't think it does. And I think the freedom to do that is quite refreshing. And we more want to ride with that rather than try and like push against it.
Do you ever feel like you're driving towards your own peril? And I'll explain what I mean, right?
Every day, but I don't know if the context is right.
Oh my God, today is the end for me.
No.
So you're creating things that have variability. You're creating this kind of novel experience for people through your products. What happens when they become commoditized? What happens when you are in the same situation as everyone else, driving the bottom line, pushing those products? You think, do you have inbuilt, let's say, mitigation to that?
Take a seat.
Couldn't be more natural.
I mean,
do you know what? You get what I mean? Like,
I think
driving you towards something that actually inherently in you, you never wanted to be, but you may be on the path to that, right?
I think my investors would disagree with me, but I kind of like the way we're changing as a company, and we're always going, like, we've got a new product we're going towards now, so it's always like we're looking at the new thing. And I don't think I have a worry about us being like this global brand, like sort of Beyond Meat, and I don't think there's a place for that.
Because it's unachievable, or because you don't want it?
I don't think there's a point to it. What's the point? The only point to it is not being better. It's being like giving money to shareholders and things like that, which my shareholders would love.
Because it's you.
But the target we've given them is achievable, and I think with it well within our capabilities to do the things in the same way we do them now. I don't think our sights are too high. I don't want to be a Cadbury's. I don't want to be. I have no idea what the pressures that bring to it. Because the idea of running a sustainable, achievable business with natural products and doing it at that level, I don't see it. I see Beyond Meat turning back to doing, trying to do what we're doing now. They're now going, oh, we want it to be, you know, we want it to be nutritious. We want it to be made. We want it to do all the stuff that we've already built in. But to try and backtrack is almost impossible for them because they've already created this thing. Whereas for us, it's just this slow moving thing, and I'm happy if we're on this steady path. Again, my investors would say, shut up. This is not what we want. But I think it's just much more sustainable to have a nice growth curve and understand that the future of this sort of product is lots of companies doing really innovative things with the products that are available to them and coming up with new ideas. I welcome that. I welcome these people doing it. I welcome people not wanting to become the next big thing because that doesn't exist.
Are you trying to make more money this year than you did last year? And are you trying to grow that for shareholders?
Yes.
You are?
We are. So I'm not sure how many people know Couplins, but we've been through quite a journey over the past few years. So in, I think it was 2021, Couplins were bought by EG Group, which is obviously a multinational business. And then in October 2025, we were bought back by local shareholders, so no longer associated with EG. And I think it's really changed how we want to grow. So we're very much focused on sustainable, slow, organic growth rather than just let's be national, let's be Greggs. That's not who we are and who we want to be. We do want more shops. We're opening new shops every week. Every couple of weeks, but we want them to be in the right places, the right locations, kind of creep out from our core area. We're not known we wouldn't work in London. We're not known there. We've got a really loyal customer base, and we need to build on that rather than just trying to go too big too soon. Not to be sustainable.
The management consultant in me again. What does the growth trajectory look like for Mondelez?
Well, supposed to be up. We've obviously had some challenges recently, but we have very clear growth ambitions. Very, very clear. I mean, they're stated publicly, and our whole business model is growing for the shareholders.
Yeah.
So that's what we are. We are a very different from these guys. We are a big multinational.
Mm-hmm.
With clear ambitions.
And I think that sometimes consumers don't necessarily understand this kind of complexity in the food industry. No. When we're talking about the food industry, to a consumer thinks of the giants, right?
Yes.
They think of the Mondelez, Unilever, big stuff. But the food industry is all of us.
Exactly.
It's everyone within it.
Yeah.
And that's very different businesses.
Yeah.
Very, very different businesses, very different livelihoods, very different products. Most often similar consumers, but at different consumption moments.
Yeah.
I think, are you guys ready to maybe take some questions from the audience?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
So does anyone have any questions for any of our panelists today?
Just wondering if any of you have any insight into the area of precision fermentation and where there are GMOs being used in the development of new products. I've seen a few things in like sweet protein. It might be antithetical to what you do, but I'd just be interested in any perspective on what you're seeing in the marketplace in terms of new products becoming available from modified precision fermentation.
So I have some background in this specifically. I mean, there is allowable genetic modification allowed for the enzymes. For like allowable enzymes, those need to be registered. So you would need to be on a register of this is a genetically modified product that is used in the making of something else. Finally, you wouldn't necessarily need to label that something has been, you have used genetic modified material in order to produce that final product. And the point is GM actually really helps you do this precision fermentation, right? It helps you specify the targets, specify exactly what you're trying to do, and optimize yields. Like, that's fundamentally what you're trying to do, make a process more efficient. I think the space is ripe and things are moving quite quickly. Any more questions for our esteemed panelists?
Hi. This one may be more for Sally and also Emily. Do you think the new generation, being Gen Z, being more aware of climate change, more sensitive to the protection of the planet, will be more willing to accept variability in a product, in a justification of any sort of crisis, like you mentioned the cocoa or the vanilla, for instance?
I mean, the Gen Z are much more sensitive to the environment. They'll do lots and lots of things to help the environment. The one thing we are seeing, though, is they won't pay more for it. So it's a real quandary within the world that they are super concerned about everything and very fickle. You know, they make choices and then they change their minds and then they do something else. But as soon as you try and target them for something that is sustainable, you know, highly natural, blah, 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 they're not necessarily buying into it. And they might buy it once. They talk about it on TikTok and then they'll go somewhere else. So it's not, from our perspective, what we're seeing at the moment, not such a sustainable model, but they are a very interesting target in terms of how do we get them to include our products in their repertoire of products, which are huge, and particularly things like, you know, meat-free alternatives and things like that, which are naturally grown and things, that they love all of that stuff. But equally, I mean, we launched a plant-based chocolate. They wouldn't pay for it. So, you know, even though they loved it, they thought it was great. It was too expensive for me. So, you know, there's a real challenge here for them.
I think to a story Before I got into the manufacturing of it, I actually opened a restaurant called Simplicity in Brick Lane. And I'd spent 2 years working on this burger and trying to do it in-house. And like the thousands and thousands of hours that I'd spent and mulling over it, waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, coming down, making something, that not being right, doing it and changing it, spending all my money in this little restaurant that I wanted to open and put all my personal cash into it, did it, hired the chefs, did it, made the things, like got these people come in. Everybody was like reviewing it before it opened. They said, this is amazing, what you've done, you know, the thing. The first customer came in and she was about 21 years old, sat down and I was so excited. And she just picked up the menu, went, £6 for a burger, no, and walked out. And that was my first key to say, it doesn't matter how good a job I do, I could like split the atom with this thing, and cost is still the biggest thing in it. And the same with supermarkets. We've had run-ins with a big supermarket chain, I won't say who, and they said, oh, we really love it because it does this, it does this. It ticks like 10 boxes that none of the other stuff in the plant-based section ticked. You know, it's sustainable. You're using British stuff. You're a London company. You're making everything here by hand. You know, it's good for you. It does this. Tim Spector loves you. All this sort of stuff comes in. And they said, yeah, we want it for £2.50. And it's like, well, that's the same price as the crap that you're already selling. And it's like, yeah, that's the price of it. And I'm like, okay, well, this doesn't work. You know, that's the most important factor. Like, I think you can't get beyond that thing. You've got to do everything for the same price as people that just don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
I think we've unfortunately run out of time. Guys, thank you so much. You've really been great. Awesome perspectives from me. Thank you very much. It was really great. And thanks for sharing your insights.
Welcome.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If this has whet your appetite for next year's Food Matters live events, you can already register your interest to partner with us in London and Rotterdam. Just head to foodmatterslive.com.